I'm Christopher Lydon with the journalist, analyst, Anatole Levin in the breakdown lane of the U.S.-Pakistan connection. How did the so-called allies in the so-called war on terror come to be shooting at each other? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Anatole Levin at the War Studies Department of King's College in London wrote the book that we saw on many desks and coffee tables in Pakistan last summer, Anatole. Pakistan, a Hard Country is his title. One of the main warnings I took out of it, Anatole, was beware the direct face-off of U.S. and NATO forces against the Pakistani army. And here we are, Pakistani army directing fire at American troops, according to our Pentagon. And over the last weekend, a NATO airstrike wiped out 24 Pakistani soldiers near the border with Afghanistan. Anatole Levin, is this what you're worried about? And what is happening?
Yes, this latest incident could have been simply a tragic accident. You know, I mean, accidents like that are liable to happen when you have large numbers of heavily armed troops close to each other, heavy air power, and guerrillas, moving between them and attacking. Well, it seems that on this occasion they began by attacking the Afghan National Army. It's possible, it has been suggested by some people, that the Afghan National Army deliberately drew the Americans into attacking the Pakistanis, who they hate. I mean, this is very bad, and we have to see where things go from here, particularly in terms of NATO supply routes to Afghanistan across Pakistan. It's not the worst, though. I mean, the worst would have been if you had had an actual prolonged battle on the ground between NATO and Pakistani soldiers. Or, of course, if US ground forces had penetrated deep into Pakistan and got into a battle with the Pakistanis there. Fortunately, that's something which, the United States has done very, very rarely. The last major occasion was in order to get bin Laden. But if that were to become a regular occurrence, then sooner or later, I think disaster would be virtually inevitable.
Secretary of State Clinton says that we are trying with Pakistan to fight the Taliban and negotiate our way out of Afghanistan at the same time. Her slogan is fight, talk, build, which is very hard for me to grasp. Take it apart.
Well, I mean, fight, talk, build, or at least fight, talk, can be a viable strategy in some places, in some circumstances. I mean, it was pretty much what the British did in Northern Ireland. But, of course, the conditions are very different. One of them is, if you're going to talk and build and fight, you probably need a long, long time. Remember, the British did that for 30 years, basically. America is essentially trying to cram this all now into barely 2 years, before President Obama says that US ground forces will begin to withdraw. So that's the first thing, is the time. Then, I mean, the other thing is what you're trying to build in Afghanistan. There is no serious chance whatsoever of being able to build up a strong Afghan state and army within the time frame available. It just isn't going to happen. And then finally, there's the talk element. Look, in the end, if there are going to be talks, the two sides have to be able to agree on something. Both sides have to be able to put forward an offer that the other side can accept, at least as a sort of minimum condition for negotiations. Now, the United States still seems far from meeting the minimal demands of the Taliban, which include, amongst other things, the complete withdrawal of US and Western forces. The Taliban, well, I mean, the part of the problem is we don't know what the minimum conditions of the United States really are. It has been suggested by former Taliban leaders that the Taliban would meet the basic conditions of excluding international terrorists and cracking down on the heroin trade, but in return only for a complete American withdrawal and a very substantial share of power in Afghanistan.
So, what is the interplay next door with Pakistan in a relationship which the Republican presidential candidate John Huntsman reminds us is and always has been a transactional relationship, a kind of fee-for-service deal? What is the deal today? And what? How is it working itself out?
The deal has always had basically three elements. The first is that Pakistan should provide, transport corridor for US and NATO forces in Afghanistan. Now, Pakistan has done that. I mean, some of the convoys have been attacked by the Taliban. And of course, on occasions, as after this latest incident, Pakistan has closed the border to Western supplies. Nonetheless, we have to see what will happen now. But for by far the greater part of the period since 9/11, Pakistan has provided an essential supply route. So that's part of the deal. The second part of the deal is that Pakistan should help against international terrorists targeting the United States directly, especially, of course, Al-Qaeda. Once again, Pakistan on the whole has done that. A lot of Al-Qaeda leaders have been arrested in Pakistan with the help of the Pakistani authorities and handed over to the United States. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi bin al-Shib, quite a lot of others. Now, there's more of a question mark over that, however, since, of course, bin Laden was located and killed, so close to a Pakistani army base. Nonetheless, I'd still say that on balance, Pakistan has been helpful there for two reasons. One is that the Pakistani elites have no interest in international terrorism directed against the West. There's absolutely nothing in it for them. While on the other hand, they know that if, God forbid, there were a major successful terrorist attack on the United States coming from Pakistan, then America might go crazy again and actually do something that would destroy Pakistan as a state. So on the first two parts of the deal, on the whole, Pakistan has been helpful. Where they have been generally quite unhelpful is, of course, in cracking down on the Afghan Taliban. And there are two reasons why they haven't done that. One is that the Pakistani security establishment believes that, America will get out again. There will be a civil war in Afghanistan and that India will be heavily involved on one side. And, the Pakistanis hate and fear the Indians. They feel, that they need allies of their own and the Taliban are the only available ones. But the second reason is that the absolutely overwhelming majority of Pakistanis, and even more strongly the overwhelming majority of Pashtuns in Pakistan, sympathise with the Afghan Taliban. That doesn't mean that they sympathise with them in ideologically, most of them, thank God. I mean, they don't want to see a Taliban-style state in Pakistan. But they believe that they're a legitimate resistance force in Afghanistan, that they're like the Mujahideen in the 1980s fighting the Soviets. Or, you could say that they're, like communist guerrillas fighting the Nazis in the Second World War. They may not like their ideology, but they believe that Afghanistan is their country and that they have the right to fight in order to kick the West out. Now, that feeling is also very, very strong in the Pakistani military. And, of course, it affects what the Pakistani military can and can't do. You have to be very careful of demanding that soldiers do something which goes clean against their fundamental beliefs.
But how firmly is the United States asking the Pakistani army to sort of betray its feelings on this issue? I mean, what are we asking them to do that is awfully hard, over the line?
Well, we're asking them to launch military offensives against Taliban bases and Taliban supporters in the border areas of Pakistan, something which they did to a very limited extent under Musharraf, under the last ruler of Pakistan. But it must be said that when they did that, they set off a rebellion, an Islamist rebellion inside Pakistan, which is continuing to this day and has killed tens of thousands of Pakistanis. So, I've been a bitter critic of Pakistani paranoia and anti-Americanism and all these things. But it must be said, I mean, the Pakistanis do have a case. It's, basically thanks to the United States that they now have a civil war inside Pakistan, which has claimed far more Pakistani lives than Americans were killed on 9/11, or than American soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan and Iraq put together.
You hear that figure, 30,000, 35,000 Pakistanis dead in this war all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that may be a bit exaggerated, but it's certainly true, you know, that getting on by now for 4,000 soldiers and police have been killed. And thousands, we're not quite sure how many thousands, of Pakistani civilians. But, you know, I mean, every week there is a major terrorist attack which kills dozens of people, you know, at a time in Pakistan. We do have to remember that. But as a result, there is, you know, there is simply no will in the Pakistani population to help the United States. We've got to remember that. You know, we keep talking about how, oh, we want to support democracy in Pakistan and so forth and so on, free public opinion. Well, let me tell you, the overwhelming democratic majority of Pakistanis want us to go to hell. Or at least they want us to go to hell, but they want us to get out of Afghanistan, and they certainly don't want to help us.
I came to think of it when we were in Pakistan as a mutually abusive marriage with permanent mutual interests under it. What does one do?
Well, yes. What does one do? But, you know, many such marriages stick together, have stuck together historically, you know, for long periods for various reasons to do with mutual interests and, you know, outside pressures and children and property and all these things. And as I say, I mean, the point is that both sides are still getting very substantial benefits from this relationship. But of course, you know, there comes a certain point at which rational calculations fly out of the window. And I don't think we're quite there yet, but, well, you know, yeah, we could be approaching it. Part of the question is, you see, whether... Does the United States have an alternative to supply routes via Pakistan? Well, the answer is yes, but they're pretty difficult. It means either going through Russia. Now, the Russians will drive a hard bargain for that, particularly when it comes to the abandonment of American missile defense plans. Or it means going via Georgia, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, basically, across the Caspian Sea. That's a long, difficult, logistically complicated journey. It means cozying up to some very nasty regimes in Central Asia. It probably requires Russian goodwill as well, you know, to support that process. So can America move to that alternative route?
Come back to Pakistan, Anatole. I came away from Pakistan thinking and hearing, I must say, from a lot of Pakistanis that Pakistan is us in many complicated ways. It was shaped as a sort of strategic foothold of convenience for the United States in Asia. They're between Russia, as you say, and India, between Iran on a western border and China on the east. It's got a Praetorian semi-state that owns a very diverse and vital country. But the powers that we are angrily entangled with in Pakistan are all basically institutions that the United States shaped, from the Pakistani army and its ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence, right down to the Haqqani network of warriors that were fighting, and the jihadis, even the Taliban, were creatures of American policy when we were getting the Soviets out. We have met the enemy, as Pogo said, and it is us. Or we've met the problem, and it is our past policy.
Well, yes, absolutely. I would say that America shaped or sort of influenced these developments rather than created them. Because, you know, it's quite true that America played what has turned out to be a disastrous role in backing the Afghan Mujahideen. The forces that became both al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Yeah, the forces that Ronald Reagan brought into the White House and said these are their founding fathers. And they sat there in the Oval Office.
Absolutely. But Pakistan can't claim any kind of innocence on this. You know, the ISI, the Zia administration in Pakistan, you know, took all this American money and these guns, and they gave them to precisely those Afghan Mujahideen that they wanted to, you know, their allies. I mean, similarly, you know, the Zia administration was propped up by Reagan after 79. But, you know, America didn't bring that military government to power in Pakistan in 77. That was a, you know, product of Pakistan's own internal developments. So, I mean, America has a great deal to answer for there and should recognise that and, you know, not be, to be blunt about it, so damned self-righteous. On the other hand, I have to say, I mean, you know, Pakistanis are chronically given to blaming everybody but themselves, you know, for what goes wrong in their country. You know, even when a lot of the time, I mean, it's not, you know, after all, Ziaz was a military, you know, a military government. Nobody elected him, but it was the government of Pakistan, you know, which was also instrumental in developing many of these problems.
Speak of the country as opposed to the state. It's part of the whole doctrine in your book that Pakistan has a weak state, but almost secretly a strong society. Draw that difference, especially for me, because my exposure was so much more to the country, the musicians, the writers, the artists, the talkers, the historians, than to the state. But how does that work out? How can the society get stronger in relation to the army that sort of owns it?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you see, in Pakistan, I mean, there isn't a society as such anymore, you know, than there is a nation, unfortunately, or a people. You know, Pakistan is a very diverse place, you know, with multiple different ethnic groups, regional interests, very different, you know, religious groups and traditions in Pakistan, a number of different ones, you know, often now at each other's throats, you know, even if they are all more or less hostile to the West. The army internally seems to be very strong and efficient. And indeed, you know, it is, in part or in large part because it has gained for itself such a huge share of the, you know, of state resources over the years. But actually, you find when the army, you know, has a military coup and takes over, at least the last two times this has happened, very little actually changes and improves in terms even of the kind of things that, you know, military governments are classically supposed to do, like, you know, old Mussolini phrase, making the trains run on time and, you know, reducing corruption and so forth. Because actually, the military always ends up working through the same old politicians. It's not... Three rulers now of Pakistan, two military, one civilian, have talked about Ataturk, you know, Kemal Ataturk of Turkey, as their model. But they don't have a Turkish nationalism behind them. That means they can't do what Ataturk did. They can't put... They can't create a nationalist party and put retired military officers into every village to sort of... to mobilise the population behind a national cause. Because, above, you know, most of the military officers are from northern Punjab or, to some extent, you know, the Pashtun areas. Send them to most of the country and the local population won't understand what they're saying because they don't speak the same language. You know, the fundamental fact, the most important fact about the Pakistani state is that it raises less than 10% of its gross national product in revenue. Sri Lanka, you know, next door in South Asia, raises almost 14%. India raises more than 17%. So the state just doesn't have the resources. It can't pay for development. It can't pay its civil servants remotely adequately. So, of course, they steal the whole time. It can't mobilise people. It can't educate people. You know, it can't educate women. So, amongst other things, you know, you have a dreadfully high birth rate, which is, you know, progressively swamping every kind of development, and so forth and so on. So, you know, you have a variety of strong societies, but unfortunately, you know, with the very, very limited exception of, you know, a very thin stratum of westernized liberals, you don't have nearly enough people in these different societies who are committed to positive change. Now, I have to say that unfortunately, that's not just true when it comes to Western liberalism, but it's also true when it comes to some sort of, you know, relatively progressive version of Islamist politics. As you're seeing in Turkey, you know, as you've seen in Turkey, as I hope we're going to see in Morocco and Tunis, perhaps, you know, moderate, democratic Islamist parties with a, you know, partially reformist agenda as far as the state is concerned. We don't have that in Pakistan yet because, unfortunately, you don't have the classes in the cities. I mean, the religious but educated and in some ways modern middle classes who can support and who can really generate that kind of party. Hence the fact that Pakistani politics, you know, is to such an extent still dominated by the so-called feudals, you know, by landowner bosses, you know, heading local clans and tribes and living off corruption.
Your mention of Turkey reminds me of a line that's attributed to Zia-ul Haq, president of Pakistan, ex-general in the 1980s. But supposedly he said, you know, if Turkey without Islam is still Turkey, Egypt without Islam is still Egypt, but Pakistan without Islam is just another version of India. So there was that motive, even in the creation of Pakistan, the conception of Pakistan, that it had to have a kind of an edgy Islamic identity. Without Islam, without a sort of fighting militant jihadist Islam, it's the not India, it's the leftovers, it's the sibling, the smaller sibling rival that among the two states that were born out of British India. That also comes back, though, to the Pakistani army, which you can picture as the sort of the cohesive, best organized force in Pakistan. But it's also an army that has fed on the India-Pakistan tensions over many, many years now and keeps them going. I'm fascinated in Pakistan and in India by the drive to do something finally about the India-Pakistan relationship, to see the whole problem not as AFPAC, as we do in our American slogan, but as Indo-Pak, as the partition problem.
Well, yes. I mean, there are two sides to this. I mean, the first is you're quite right. I mean, the Pakistani military, you know, it's not just a question of having more money. The Pakistani military does have a strong internal ethos. And that ethos is Pakistani nationalism. The military is the only institution in Pakistan which really embodies this nationalism. But the problem is, of course, as we know about nationalism, you know, nationalism, especially in states that are weak or endangered, you know, nationalism feeds off nationalist hatred. And in the case of Pakistan, that hatred is directed against India. And it is, you know, the military is absolutely seeped in this. Now, on the other hand, I mean, it must be said that when Pakistani leaders, which was true of General Musharraf, at least after 9/11, not before, and it was true of President Zardari in his first years, when they have suggested much greater flexibility on solving the issue of Kashmir, which is the critical issue between the two countries, the Indians have not really responded. And you know that there is also an enormous amount of just blind obstructionism on the Indian side, as witnessed, for example, by the fact that when Holbrooke, you know, was first appointed as the, you know, Chief Obama representative for Afghanistan-Pakistan, the initial idea was that he was also going to cover the Kashmir issue and try to bring about a settlement between India and Pakistan. That, I think, would seem to most Americans completely reasonable. You know, you have jihadi groups in Pakistan and indeed beyond which are feeding off this issue. It's strengthening militancy within Pakistan. It's distracting Pakistan from the fight against terrorism. You know, allowing or encouraging the Pakistani military to back terrorists against India. There's the permanent risk of another Mumbai leading to, you know, possibly, God forbid, even war between two nuclear-armed states and so forth and so on. So it seems perfectly reasonable that America, you know, should be involved in trying to mediate this. This was shot down, you know, almost within hours by India and by the Indian lobby within the United States. It was simply swept off the table, you know, by pressure from Delhi and within Congress.
We met interesting people in Pakistan and actually a few in India too who would love to ease the force of that border all across India and Pakistan, not just around Kashmir, but in terms of a passage of people, but also banking, trade. I mean, it's It's very, very strange that Pakistan cannot trade with its booming big neighbor on its border, built of the same people in a sense that built Pakistan too, in societies that were always connected.
Yeah. But, you know, once again, the U.S. is not blameless there, or at least one has to understand the U.S. position. But, you know, the Pakistanis are very interested in promoting, you know, as part of détente with India, if that can be achieved, the Pakistanis would like to promote an energy corridor from Iran to India across Pakistan. America has always, of course, bitterly opposed this because of hostility to Iran. Instead, America is promoting, you know, the idea of an energy and transport corridor across Afghanistan. I must honestly say that there are very few serious regional experts I know who think that that is going to be a viable economic possibility, you know, in the near to medium term.
Anatol Levin, in your book, Pakistan, a Hard Country, you come back to the notion that part of what's fascinating here is that this country could plausibly, imaginably, melt down. It could also plausibly recover in rather striking ways, not least the fact, as many Pakistanis will tell you, that it's ideally located for business. There it is between the world's factory, China, and the world's oil supply in the Gulf, between Russia and booming India, 8-10% growth India. What are the prospects, do you think?
Well, I mean, the potential, as you say, is there. You know, Pakistan was named, you know, as one of, I think it was called the next 11 by this study, which suggested, you know, that as the cost of labor goes up in China, population ages, you know, low-cost manufacturing will move to new countries. And Pakistan could be one of those. The Pakistanis, as I have to say, as all too often, have a way of sort of sitting back and saying, oh, well, so, you know, we don't need to worry, you know, everything will come right in the end. And they also tell themselves that China will come to their aid. You know, they're China's ally, so China will, you know, in the long run, Chinese business will come to Pakistan and so forth and so on. Well, the thing is, unless they do a great... Well, two things. A, unless there is a deal with India that opens Indian markets. And B, if Pakistanis themselves do an enormous amount, not just to stabilise their country, but to improve their government, reduce corruption and so forth, then, well, you know, as a Chinese banker told me, it would get a categorical order from the Chinese government to get most Chinese businessmen to invest in Pakistan. Because, of course, they have exactly the same worries about their investments as Western businessmen do. You know, it isn't going to happen automatically. The potential is there, but, you know, Pakistan needs to do a colossal amount, you know, to improve its internal situation. And, you know, corruption is a huge part of the problem. I mean, I talked to one of the last, you know, all the new, the only new Western businessman I met in recent years trying to work in Pakistan. And, you know, his portrait of the, you know, both the scale but also the chaotic nature of corruption was just, you know, I mean, so discouraging for any businessman. You know, he said that you paid and paid and paid, and then you were told that, you know, you'd paid off everybody, now the project could go ahead. And then you found that another group popped up and was demanding money and was in a position to block what you were doing if they didn't get the money, you know, which he said made any kind of, you know, planned investment very, very difficult.
Anatol, even come back to the beginning and these dust-ups between American military forces, the Pakistani army, which are in the headlines. It looks like improvised maneuvering towards some sort of new relationship, new deal. Where is it going?
Well, there are two ways it should be going. The first is, you know, perhaps the most likely way that it will go, which is that Pakistan will get more money from the United States. There will be certain US assurances that, you know, this won't happen again. And then things will go on as they are before. And of course, most of that money will go, surprise, surprise, to the Pakistani military. Now, that is, you know, I mean, it avoids a really dreadful crisis, but it also, in a way, just, you know, it postpones the crisis. You know, it means that there's going to be another crisis down the line. The way that I would support, but, you know, which the sensible elements in the Pakistani military are advocating, including directly to the Americans, would be an attempt at a genuine negotiation with the Afghan Taliban on the future of Afghanistan. Now, they have to involve, amongst other things, a discussion of changing the Afghan constitution. But, you know, that should be quite possible for the United States and, indeed, even the government in Kabul. Because, you know, I mean, the really terrifying thing about US policy is that nobody knows what is going to or who is going to follow or what setup will follow Hamid Karzai when he steps down, as he has to, according to the Constitution, in 2013. Now, you know, you talk to US officials and they say, well, you know, this is a matter for the Afghan people, blah, 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 blah. But that's ridiculous. You can't be asking American soldiers to die for an Afghan state if, in fact, you don't know what that state is going to be 3 years down the line.
The one political figure that I wish I had interviewed in Pakistan was this Imran Khan, great cricket star, great national celebrity, sort of a populist, independent candidate for the leadership, who would happily say goodbye to the United States in Pakistan, would make some sort of peace, as you're suggesting, with the Taliban in Afghanistan. What's wrong with Imran Khan?
Well, my own view, you know, having travelled extensively in the cities of northern Pakistan, is that if this were a presidential election like the United States, he probably would win. He's certainly vastly more popular than any other politician I know. But of course, it isn't. You know, Pakistan has a strange mixture, but in the end, power depends on having a majority in parliament. So, there's no doubt that Imran Khan has enormous support, but the question is, what will it actually lead to?
But why shouldn't outsiders like us in the States, Britain for that matter too, take careful note of a direction that has big popular support in Pakistan?
Well, I would say that, no, I entirely agree. I mean, what we need to do is be completely honest with ourselves that the problem we have in Pakistan is not simply, the problem with the Pakistani Secret Service and the army and so forth, that we have a real problem with Pakistani democracy, you know, that most Pakistani voters oppose what we are doing and support, you know, that sympathise with the Taliban in Afghanistan and support the idea of a peace settlement that will lead to complete American withdrawal. People have blamed Pakistan very much, and often quite rightly, for its policies towards Afghanistan. But if we have any sincerity in our commitment to Pakistani democracy, and to good, you know, basically good wishes towards the Pakistani people, then we also need to, to take that these views into account. And these views are strongly articulated by Imran Khan. I mean, Imran Khan, who, of course, as we all know, is a very strong Pakistani nationalist, but how sincerely I would not like to say, rediscovered his, religion in recent years. But of course, he is in absolutely no sense an Islamist or a jihadi or an extremist from a religious point of view. So, in a certain sense, if we can't reach some sort of, settlement with people like Imran Khan, well, how the hell can we deal with Pakistan in the long run?
Good question. Anatol Levin, it's a joy to hear your voice again. And it was a great pleasure to read your book, Pakistan, a Hard Country. I've been through it several times now, and I'll read it again.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.